Hello and welcome to the Beyond Biotech podcast number 56. I'm Jim Cornell with the Biotech podcast, and today, July the 28th, is Independence Day in Peru, and it's also National Talk in an Elevator Day, which is all well and good, but I'm not sure where the nearest elevator is. There's definitely not one in our tiny village, nor is there one in the nearest town. So I'm not about to drive to Glasgow just to have people look at me like I've lost my mind for talking in an elevator, or a lift, as they are called in the UK. It's almost the end of July as well, which seems to have flown by and apparently looks like being the hottest July ever on record. And still, climate change gets ignored. I did manage to get out walking this weekend, as the terrible forecast was indeed a terrible forecast, because it was dry and not wet as predicted. So we took off for the islands and generally wandered about the place, as did lots of other tourists. We counted vehicles from 14 different European countries, and I had to give directions several times, actually including to a local woman who was lost on one of the hikes. And we even listened to the local radio station in Gaelic for a bit. I didn't understand a word of it, but the music was good. Unlike in Ireland, they don't teach Gaelic in the schools here, which is a great relief to our son. Anyway, it's now time to tell you who's on the podcast with us this week, and it's one interview with two people, as we're going to explore the world of biotech entrepreneurship with Stefan Emmert, the director of BaseLaunch, and Cy Reddy. So now it's time for the news you may have missed over at labiotech.eu. We had an article on sarcoma research. Crescendo Biologics has raised $32 million and expanded its cancer trial, and Molecure has raised $12 million and received FDA clearance for its pulmonary sarcoidosis trial. Can the microbiome help the fight against infections? You'll have to read it to find out. Triastec has announced positive results from its printed oral treatment for ulcerative colitis. We had an article on weight loss drugs and one on antibody drug conjugates as Bivictrix drives a new era in cancer medicine. Researchers have discovered that a diabetes drug could be repurposed to promote healthy aging. Epsilogen has completed its first clinical trial of an antibody to treat cancer. And RecBio's shingles vaccine clinical trial has been approved in China. Chain Biotech has raised funds for its therapeutic immune oncology platform. A natural sweetener could help address Alzheimer's disease. And we had an article on what you need to know about the European Health Technology Assessment Regulation before the deadline. We had an article on cell and gene therapy regulations, and you can read these and many more at labiotech.eu. And now it's time for today's interview. BaseLaunch is more than a biotech incubator. It's a catalyst, a springboard, and a launch pad for biotech startups. Since 2018, BaseLaunch has supported 21 ventures. 10 of them have already raised venture capital financing and have collectively raised more than $550 million in financing. Not only does BaseLaunch offer financial support, but also facilitates team building, access to partners, IP licensing, and introductions to global venture funds. So today we'll be diving into the approach of BaseLaunch that tailors support according to each venture's specific needs. And joining us are Stefan Emmert, the Director of Business Development and Operations at BaseLaunch, and Cy Reddy, who has first-hand experience navigating that journey. And so we will start with a little background from Stefan.
I'm a biochemist by training, with a PhD in epigenetics and RNA interference from the FMI, which is a research institute sponsored and run out of the Novartis research arm, but affiliated with the University of Basel. And then I did small stints in postdoc in Roche, and then in medical affairs in a smaller company. And then basically joined and built up BaseLaunch from scratch to where they are now. which is basically an incubator to help launch and grow new biotech companies to a stage where they can have a life on their own, which for us means acquire full-on venture capital financing.
I'm Sai Reddy. I'm a professor at ETH Zurich at the Department of Biosystems, which is physically located in Basel. I have been running a research group here for about 11 years, and the research we focus on is at the interface of immunology and genome technologies, including sequencing and computational analysis of immune responses. I've been involved on a few entrepreneurial activities and spinoffs and on advisory boards, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that as well later today.
How and when do you decide to transition out of a research lab into a new venture?
Yes. So in my field of research, it's closer to molecular and cellular therapeutics. And the decision point of when to take it out of the research lab and into a, let's say, commercial or spin-off company setting is pretty clear and demarcated by the types of data that you need to generate to continue to advance a company and the scale of which you need to generate that data. In an academic environment, you may be able to get one or two postdocs or PhD students, a couple of master's students, and maybe you can make some progress on something, at least preclinical data. This is usually data in cell lines, maybe mouse models. But in the field of therapeutics, you need to eventually get to a stage where you do things that are, let's say, under much larger scale in terms of the types of studies, maybe much larger animal models or animal studies, eventually using human samples or eventually human clinical studies, and then as well, oftentimes many more resources in terms of people and financing. And those things aren't usually typically possible in an academic environment, at least not in Switzerland as much, especially if you're not a clinician. You certainly are very far away from being able to do any kind of clinical studies. So that's a very clear point where you know that, of course, if you continue to do the work in academia, you won't be able to make much progress that gets you closer to human studies. You might get, you know, other interesting papers, more, you know, additional technology, but it doesn't necessarily advance the therapeutic. And so that's usually the clear sign that there is not a lot left to do in the academic environment. Basically, your project outgrows an academic lab. And that's when the decision about spinning off a company becomes more apparent.
Yeah, I mean, I can add, and I very much agree with that. Eventually, you need to take the project out of academia into a commercial setting, because also the mindsets and the speed can change a lot then. On the other hand, I think it's very important to exploit as long as you can academic resources for many reasons, because once you spin out the company, you'll have to license the patents. And then also on there, you'll always have diligence milestones, which you need to fulfill in certain time periods to maintain the license. So it's also important not to form a company too early, because as a venture funds, we're not investing in very early projects. So that's kind of also what we try to do, is finance these first few gaps to generate more data, which you cannot generate academically anymore, because you have to go to CROs, or you might have to discuss and find more on the IP, or you might have to do some toxicology experiments, which are not really financeable. So when this time comes, I think it's when one should start a company. But at the same time, it's really good to try to push it as far as you can within the university settings. And so I did that with the last company we worked together with, which is Engineum. They did a tremendous amount of research. I would also say translation data already within this group, very good mouse data, and anything else was there already. On the other hand, if you start a company which is based on a new target and that's all you have, nothing really acting on the target or not any data, let's say on an antibody which shows any effect, then it might be too early and you should still stay a bit longer in academia. But it's a very fine line to not stay too long, because eventually you also need to try to gain speed. So it's not the most easy decision. You also then need to add more people. It costs money. You have to do all the business related things, like, again, licensing the IP, thinking hard about indications and the financing plan. So many, many things start coming together once you form a company. So I think it's great to really think through hard when is the right time. Then not trying to contemplate for another 2 years, should I or should not. I think the signs are eventually clear and then you should do it. also because the people involved in these projects want to see them progress and want to progress them.
You kind of touched on staffing already very briefly. I wonder if you could go into a bit more detail on how to find the right team members for ventures and what's the most important thing to consider.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is actually that you have someone from the ventures on the front, from the founding team, or several of them really pushing hard. So you do need them to be very much involved and taking ownership and wanting to move this project forward. So I think that is key, to have the founders really, really heavily involved in these companies. At the same time, eventually, since there's many other things to think about besides the scientific developments on all the aspects of, let's say, financing the company's partnerships, it's the ideal situation if you find at the very beginning almost someone who has industry experience where you also click very well. I think that's very important, that the people who form the teams work very well together. Now, that's also, I think, what works for us the best, if the personalities click well. And then ideally form the company together, or you have a chairperson at the beginning to get with the founding team, or even a CEO who then works alongside the company's founders to, as a team, build them out further. I think it needs both sides, and neither of them can succeed too well on their own. But the most important thing is really, in our view, is that they are complementary, but also that they work well together. I don't know how you see this side, but I assume you've gone through a few of those now. So,
yeah, I think that there's a few factors, you know, and sometimes it's just a sequencing of events, which is that when you first start a spinoff company, you typically don't have financing yet of any substantial proportion. So the only people you can really hire are either very flexible people who are willing to handle that uncertainty, which are, you know, in some cases, recent graduate students or recent postdocs. They might be willing to do this. But then on the other side of it, the executives and the more, you know, leadership teams that you might need with experience are often difficult to secure at that early stage. They become much easier after you do raise financing, because then there's a structure in place. In the beginning, that's also why one of the advantages of working with Base Launch is they can provide a few additional resources to provide access to experts, advisors who can help you at this early stage, who may not be part of the founding team or employment team, but at least have valuable contributions in kind of short consulting meetings. Yeah. So the team aspect has to be very almost amorphous at the very beginning prior to financing being secured, because, you know, there may be people on your team, which quote unquote team, which are just advisors that you meet with twice, but they may have very important contributions nevertheless.
And in terms of defining your own role in the company, how do you do that?
Yeah. So, and myself, my own situation, obviously, as a full-time employee of the university, I have most of my responsibilities there. The university, ETH, does give me 20% time flexibility to work on other activities, including things like spinoff companies. This is common for many academics, so it's not particularly unique about ETH Zurich for this situation. So the question is, what could I do with that 20%? If I now have multiple companies, obviously I have to split them among the different companies, as well as maybe some other activities. The role that I see myself playing in my current companies, and if any get started in the future, is to help in scientific strategy at the very early stages. So this could be as a member of the scientific advisory board. It could just be as a consultant. It may be as well as a member of the board of directors, at least in the early stages, it makes a lot of sense if there's a lot of research going on. So where I see myself is basically scientific advice, scientific collaborations. So many of my spinoff companies eventually, not many, but the two that I've had have also established a collaboration with my academic research lab. So I basically play kind of a dual role there, where I just advise the science that's a collaborative project. So basically my role is to try to emulate what my day job is, which is providing expertise on a scientific topic and advice. And that's where I can play a role in the company. I have limited roles, nor would I want to take any type of roles on things that are really management, financial based, even fundraising, only a limited amount could I really support that with. So those are, like, for me, the clear area, and where I can actually add the most value is on the research and scientific expertise side.
Anything there, Stefan?
We are not in the companies, right? What we usually do is, once we take a funding decision, at the beginning, we try to be as much involved as needed. And that's very often a lot to help them get going from forming the company. We are almost always involved in help licensing the IP and then also further defining, let's say, where to go on the indications and whatnot. And once this is figured out, one can calculate basically backwards on what kind of data you need to generate. We also always get input from our partners and others that fuse into that process. And it basically starts with weekly or twice a week calls where we discuss all related matters. And in parallel, we try to identify who could step into the company. As I mentioned, basically at that time, an external person who can eventually become, for instance, the chairperson or the CEO. We look with the team who will fit and help bring this person in. We also know how the basically remunerations can work. At this time, it's usually for shares. And once this person is in, many of the things we're doing at the early stages, we then do together with him and or her, and basically let the companies further build themselves out as a team. And then we usually, once the initial steps are done, we move to maybe a call every week or a call every 2 weeks to then really just be there to be helpful wherever it's needed. Because also once all the things are defined, and we also define how our money is used for, what kind of experiments, then it's often also waiting. You need to start generating more data to see that what you do has hand and feet. Some companies are quicker where the data's almost there already, and then we can help them immediately from the get-go try to acquire follow-on financing, either from our partners or also from other venture funds. Also do deals, and then it's more involved in that one. But very often it's helping at the very beginning to put the comps on solid feet and define everything. And then basically also let new data come in, which also informs a lot the next steps then, which might then evolve from there. But we're all not formal team members of any of these companies. We're only four people. So we also are not involved in boards or anything. We don't have the capacity, meaning we don't have the time for this. But we try to really help them set up everything at the beginning correctly and then further develop the companies.
And I assume every company is different, but what factors need to be considered when it comes to fundraising and taking the first steps there?
It very much depends on the markets. Now they're a bit more difficult than in the past. So in the past, you could try to build big technology platforms out of which you generate one asset after the other and try to acquire big rounds of financing. Now I think the markets have changed a bit and investors are again more looking into the individual assets they're financing. The rounds are a bit smaller. But having said that, I think there's still enough venture funds out there with enough money to invest. But then if you go into details, it basically comes down to the quality of the science and then also the competition, what else is out there to look for. And then I think it's also important to think hard where the first financing round will bring you to. So either towards the clinic or maybe even towards a clinical proof of concept, to think through hard of that one and then also a bit the clinical strategy. But in the ending, I think each company is very different and there's probably no common denominator besides the quality of the science definitely needs to be there and the quality of the team. I think these are the two most important aspects and anything else is very individual on each company.
Yeah, I would agree with Stefan that basically it's very case-by-case basis. It's a lot of, the quality of the science, the team, and the business model, as there are different. I mean, Base Launch experiences, very much or guides companies working on therapeutics. So there is a very unique business model around building a company that's going to try to make a therapeutic because of the extended timelines involved and the amount of resources before any revenue would ever come in, which is extremely long. But there are different business models in the biotech space, which could be more service platform based, partnership based, where revenues can come in much faster. And then you have to think very carefully, do you even want to raise money? And there are some scenarios where, like in my first company, DeepCDR, we were able to establish partnerships at the very beginning of the company that we could build and grow and sustain a team and pay for the team to do the work without having to raise capital from investors. The company was acquired shortly after it started, only 2 years after it really started. And that was a unique advantage in that we didn't raise any financing, and thus the acquisition could be really controlled by the founders. This will never be the case probably for a therapeutics company because of the amount of resources needed. So then you have to adopt a very different attitude and strategy. And it's okay to, and I wouldn't, and again, it's case by case. You know, there is at least one company that I would considering being spinning off from the lab, which would be, again, a therapeutics company, which will have to raise venture capital money. But there's another company that I'm debating as well, potentially spinning off, which would actually be technology and partnership based. And there we would actively try to operate the company without raising venture capital financing. So we try that again and see what's possible. I would say it's really case by case basis.
And what kind of qualities are important in an investor? Or is it just a case of if you've got money, that's good enough?
I think it's very important. This is, I mean, and not just talking of therapeutics and biotech. This is such a highly specialized field that I think it's important to have people who understand this, which are usually in the biotech venture funds, which, yes, the money is key here. Because without money, you can't do anything. But I think this is so much driven by experience that you do need people who have done that and seen that before to weigh in with their experience. I don't think you can take any investor that has basically zero experience in this field. I mean, you can, but ideally you get someone from the usual venture funds in, because they will take board seats and have a lot of say in these companies. And you do want to have people in these boards who understand the business and the science and the markets and the technologies well enough to make informed decisions. And they're usually sitting in these biotech venture funds. I mean, we are ourselves partnering with one called Pureos, which is a great partner. They also invested into size company engineering. And they very well know the field. And I think that's important to have people like that involved. They also do add on, they're also all very connected and then can help you with the next round of fundraising to bring in their colleagues as well. Because fundraising is very hard and it goes via networks. So the more you have direct ways into venture funds, we do have that, but it's also good if the funds which are investing in the company then help you do the next round. And that's another added benefit of working with sector-specific investors or venture funds.
So moving on a little, to what extent do you think that the environment or the ecosystem helps entrepreneurs, or does it even play a role?
I think it plays a big role, and for all the obvious reasons around the talent and the experience. I think what is often also overlooked is that what you often need is an ecosystem which is kind of fluid, in the sense that these companies are all very risky, and it's very hard to convince professionals, also if you've raised money, to join them out of their secure jobs in larger companies. And the reason are not so much that the companies cannot pay them. The reason is more what happens if these companies fail. What is their next job then? I think that's one of the most important aspects of an ecosystem, is that you kind of lower the bar of people to take risks, in the sense that they're quite sure if it doesn't work, they'll find their next job. And I think that is something you can do in Basel, and that is something you have in Boston and a few other places. But I think that's a key driver of forming new companies, to lower the risk of employees joining, not needing to worry too much about the job afterwards if it fails. Obviously, if it goes fine, that's nice, but often the outcomes are the other way around. And then people really need to think hard to do this jump.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Biotech is, as we've mentioned already and said, very complicated and unique business space. It's very different than other, let's say, academic spinoffs that might be software-based, computer-based, could be, sales-based, and an app. It could be even like mechanical. A lot of my colleagues in mechanical engineering are always involved with industry-based activities. So it's very different than that, where sometimes you can see progress very quickly. Biotech will be a long road towards progress, and there will be a lot of intermittent people along the way who will, or are necessary. Of course, a lot of the time, the attention goes to founders and CEOs, and they get a lot of attention. And usually you can recruit those people if you're financed as a company, because, you know, they have some special opportunities when you can get a leadership role. But all of these in-between positions, which are still critical for success, whether they're research associates or regulatory people or other translational experts and scientists, as Stefan said, if having an ecosystem is really helpful, because, you know, these companies are volatile. Many will go up and down, and in places where there is an ecosystem, there is comfort because of that, and that there's always another job. In fact, it can sometimes go in the other direction, in that the ecosystem is so vibrant, like in Boston, where it's actually really hard to retain talent. People are constantly trying to steal talent away from you because there's so many companies and so many opportunities. We're not, I think, at that phase in Basel. Basel has a very good ecosystem, but I think in biotech, it can be better. It should, you know, I hope double or triple over the next 10 years so that there are, you know, many, many biotech companies that are very innovative, not just kind of, oh, there's a few biotech companies and then there are these pharma giants around us. I think it would benefit Basel a lot for the biotech ecosystem to grow even more.
And as in every other walk of life, there's a lot of advice out there. How do you decide what's good advice, what's not good advice, and make up your own mind?
I think that is hard at the beginning. But I think what you need is, what we always say is, I think you need people who can really do actual work. Many people try to meet for coffee and talk, which is very helpful to get going. But eventually, you need really someone putting up a project plan or starting to, I don't know, look into pharmacology and comment on that one, or whatever it is. But it's going from advice to more consulting and doing actual work. And I think that's where you then see which people can do that and which not. And I think that's an important transition to take. Because at the beginning, you have literally hundreds of people trying to get in touch, provide advice. But I think you need to take it to the next step then. Because in the ending, this is, I don't know, it's science and technology and whatnot. And this is something you really need to really provide input, which goes deep. And then I think you see which people can do that and which ones not.
There are some good practices and principles around biotech, but the tough thing about it is, because it changes, the dynamic and the landscape changes pretty quickly. You don't want to take necessarily the advice of someone who had a lot of success, let's say in 2005, and then assume you can run the same playbook in 2023. Oftentimes you cannot. So that's always one of those challenging situations. You may not even want to purely take the advice of people who've succeeded, because sometimes their success might have been luck, might have been circumstance. It may not have been necessarily their strategy. But if you overweight their success, that wouldn't necessarily translate for you. What's interesting is, in the US, there is a culture of accepting failure more. And one of the benefits of that is that people failed, quote unquote, entrepreneurs, or people who failed once before, are still attractive because they will have learned a lot. And if they want to do it again, you know, an investor or whatever colleague for those people view them as actually very good to invest in potentially, because they know what mistakes to avoid this time. We don't have that so much here, where I think if you have a stigma of a failed company, it may be very hard to do it again, although there are exceptions to that rule. So yeah, so advice you have to is very interesting, because you will get different sides of it. And sometimes you actually have to just look at the source and say, is this source, do your diligence on the source that's giving you the advice, in addition to the advice itself.
And I think also you can't outsource decision making. You need to have people working with you, and kind of you need to distill the different inputs, sometimes it's going against each other, and then you need to make up your own mind and then make your own decisions. I think you can't outsource decision taking and key points where you decide. And I also think that you have to also be very frank of saying no.
When's it beneficial to join an incubator?
I think if you start a new company and are at the time to get going, but where it becomes also clear, and you can talk to funds and whatnot before, it also becomes clear that there are still gaps, I think then it's the ideal time. We always talk to people where we tell them, when we look at new projects, one of the very first things we tell them, especially if they're quite advanced, if it makes sense, or if they're already that far down the road to be able to convince funds to invest, then it's probably not that beneficial. Whereas if you still need to further develop on all aspects from the science to the business to anything else, then it might make sense. It's kind of how our thinking goes. And obviously, we are also biased in the sense that we work with 6 pharma comps and a venture fund and projects they're very interested in. That's the ones we want to move on. And that's also the focus of us, which then also informs a lot of what projects we're investing, because we have a board which is composed of all of them, which we need to convince. So,
what other factors are there that can play a role in success? And I know that Sai mentioned being lucky earlier. Do you just have to be lucky as well?
Yeah, I mean, I would say clearly, yes. I mean, you're always looking backwards. You do see sometimes the coincidences which led you further. And I think, I mean, you can call that luck, or you can also call it you exploit opportunities. But in the ending, there's always a bit of luck in it that needs to work.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think it's, you know, it's that balance of luck with discipline and preparation so that you can actually identify an opportunity when you see it rather than realize it, you know, 6 months late, which many people do, right? So you can call it luck, you can call it serendipity, you can call it coincidence. There's many different ways to call it, but being prepared and ready for opportunities is really the key. And I wouldn't say that that's always going to be luck. Some of it is actually going to be based on the hard work and efforts of people involved to take on things that they might have, as examples, they might do things that they think are very peripheral or even in some cases not contributing to something of a company that they're working on. And that actually ends up creating an opportunity later. Like these are the ways these networks and things come together. You know, you can call that luck, but sometimes that's actually just hard work.
It's forcing luck, right? In a way.
Yeah, good point. Ironically, we were talking earlier about when to take advice and when to not take advice. But if you were to give some advice for companies, what do you think that advice would be?
No, good question. Don't be shy to talk to people early on. Many people don't feel comfortable sharing anything and always are afraid of someone else exploiting that. But very often, A, you have patents around it, so that should protect you a bit. And then these things are so complicated and so much the devil is in the details that high level, also showing data, you can always do. You just be sure that you don't show anything really IP sensitive or IP relevant or confidential. But I do think talking to people early on is important.
Yeah, I would agree. And as someone who is involved on the invention side of some of the things that may be valuable for IP, they're very hard and they're not always so obvious and clear. So you can feel more comfortable talking about it to people because even if you reveal something, they might still not believe you or be ready to invest a lot of resources to change their trajectory to follow your idea, you know, that you might already have IP on. There's actually fairly minimal risk in biotech at times, I think, because the pathway to success is so long and takes so many things to get there that someone trying to quickly copy something you do probably is really rare. You know, this is different in other industries. Maybe you can get a product to the market in 3 months if you work faster, and then all of a sudden the timeline is so short that then you have to be very, very careful. In biotech, not nearly as much. And most of the things that'll be funded for spinoff companies are going to be something that's challenging an idea that's not entrenched necessarily in the exact same way things people have done, which then will come with additional scrutiny, skepticism, criticism, which makes it even less likely that someone would ever steal it. So I do agree that talking about it, engaging on it, and then refining your message. A very clear example of this is the dynamic has changed substantially in biotech in the last 2 years, as Stefan has mentioned, where it's now much more going to be heavily weighted towards the product, towards the therapeutic indication, and less so than on a platform and on a dream of making 100 drugs from your platform. Those had a lot of excitement for a while, like the last 10 years, but that has, you know, shifted a lot, I've seen in the last 2 years.
All right, for the second week in a row, next week's interview is done, although it isn't edited this time. It's going to be about Group B strep. And by then we will be well into August, the most expensive month in our household for birthdays. I also signed the family up to do a sponsored walk in August. I did ask first, though. So that date, August the 20th, is guaranteed to be rainy, at least here. The walk is at night time as well to beat the heat. That's probably just wishful thinking because it's probably not going to be warm. Anyway, thanks a lot for joining us. I hope you enjoyed this week's subject, and I hope wherever in the world you are, you have a great week ahead. Take care, and you'll join us next time for another Beyond Biotech.